So okay. Let me just recap. So the program begins at the internship year.
Right.
They come in, and they're basically afforded entrance in not only into the internal medicine residency program, but they are also guaranteed acceptance into any fellowship program within the Department of Medicine.
Here.
At Washington University.
Okay.
Because usually otherwise it's a two-application process. You apply for
right.
your internship, you finish your residency, or during your last year of your residency, then you apply to your subspecialty.
Mm-hmm.
So since we're interested in individuals continuing their academic training here, individuals accepted within this program are guaranteed acceptance through their entire internal medicine residency as well as their subspecialty fellowships. There are certain seminar series or lectures that are provided for the trainees during the six-year period. Not that they're going to do any lab work, but just so that they keep up with sort of where the general fields are going. They're assigned mentors who are themselves physician scientists, either based on their clinical interests, clinical subspecialty interests, or their research interests. And they're to meet with these particular individuals just to discuss anything from career planning to selection of laboratories.
Mm-hmm.
They're also guaranteed that once they begin their laboratory years, they're not to have any additional clinical responsibilities aside from the responsibilities that are required for board certification.
I.e. the one half day a week.
Whatever
it is.
Whatever
this
board certificate. Certain subspecialties have slightly different
right.
requirements.
Okay.
But this is just to prevent, when the people are in the lab, they're sort of the low man in the totem pole.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and it's very hard for those individuals when the division chief or the program director calls you up to go to the VA hospital or to come on mm-hmm. to service a month and say no. But this program basically already says no.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, what it also does is that it gives them certain financial advantages to minimize the need for moonlighting. It's not going to make them rich, but many of the house staff as well as fellows moonlight to obtain additional income because, you know, they may be in a position whereby their spouse doesn't work, they have kids, and on just the fellow salary, mm-hmm. that makes it extremely tight. And with the additional stipends that are given through the program, what it obviates the need for is the need to moonlight
mm-hmm.
because they're supplemented to a degree that they basically have to moonlight two shifts every 3 weeks to make up the difference. Now, moonlighting, I think, is just detrimental because it's not just the day that you moonlight, but usually you're so exhausted that it takes up the next 2 days for you
mm-hmm.
to recover.
Mm-hmm.
So what the program does is provide infrastructure, not necessarily because we know what the formula for success is.
Mm-hmm.
We know the formulas for failure.
Mm-hmm.
And what the program does is takes out the things that we know contribute to failure
mm-hmm.
and allow the trainees to at least have the least number of obstacles and the most favorable environment
mm-hmm.
for their success.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, it's obviously still up to them.
Mm-hmm. And what does one have to do to get into this program?
Well, when they're applying for house staff program, they have to indicate that they, either because they're MD PhDs or MDs with an extraordinary number of amount of research experience, have to indicate to us that they're interested in the career in academic medicine.
I see.
In which case, we then have a committee to evaluate and interview them subsequently, but to evaluate whether their scientific accomplishments warrants them to be in the program, because
right.
we have to be sure that these people really are outstanding both in
mm-hmm.
the research laboratory as well as the
mm-hmm.
clinical arena.
Mm-hmm.
Because after all, we're guaranteeing them acceptance into any one of our fellowship programs also.
Now,
from that standpoint, it's extremely competitive.
Right.
I mean, we interviewed 60-plus individuals this past year, and we offered 8 slots.
Oh, wow. So it's very competitive.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, it sounds like a wonderful idea. The only question I have about it is most people split their training up and go somewhere else for the the fellowship because they get exposure to different ideas and whatnot. So is it advantageous to stay in the same institution for both?
Well, for their clinical and their postdoctoral training, it's very, very different. Okay, I mean, I would recommend, there are certain students that, if they're coming from our program, where I would say it's probably not advantageous for them. But for many of them, for a variety of reasons, primarily family-related, they want to stay in the area.
Uh-huh.
Okay? And actually, we value our students probably as a class more so because we know what the quality of the products are.
Mm-hmm.
But for somebody that's coming in from another university, they're going to get their clinical training, and then they're going to go back to the research side.
Right.
And if they're coming from the outside, from an outside research experience, this is going to be a totally different research experience.
Right.
And in terms of the strengths of the basic sciences here at Washington University, there are very few fields that we don't adequately cover.
Mm-hmm.
So, I forgot. One of the major strengths of the program is that they actually can work in any laboratory in the entire university. They're not limited to just the laboratories within the Department of Medicine.
Oh, I see.
So they can go across the street and work for a basic science laboratory,
mm-hmm.
working on differentiation in flies, for example.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And then obviously we want them to come back across the street and attract them back to bring that kind of technology back into whatever clinical, relevant, or scientific problems that they want to address.
Mm-hmm.
So I think for anyone from outside the program, or outside the community, and even from people within the community, because they have so many opportunities to go in different directions, that it does not, end up as a disadvantage for them.
So they don't have any trouble getting jobs afterwards?
Well, we hope not. This program it's in its infancy.
Oh, I see.
Okay, it's just been, we've had an informal program for about 3 to 4 years. But with the new department chairman coming in, we've actually had additional resources.
I see.
So we will see what the rate of success is.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot imagine that we would do anything to make it less than what it is presently. If anything, I think this program is clearly going to improve on what we presently have right now or before the program was instituted, which is really not any significant infrastructure.
Okay. So, do you yourself in your lab have any fellows? You mentioned postdocs, but I don't know if those are graduate students who are postdocs or MD, PhD people who are fellows.
I have a spectrum of postdoctoral fellows. So postdoctoral fellows are anybody who's actually finished a doctorate degree.
Okay.
So graduate students don't fall into that category.
Right.
So out of the 4 postdoctoral fellows I have 2 people that are MD that are PhDs.
Okay.
I have 1 MD PhD fellow.
Uh-huh.
And I have an MD fellow.
Oh. Okay.
So I basically have the range of the kinds of individuals that you have.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, tell me about the 4 schools program.
So the 4 schools program has been around for about 12 years. And it was started as a program, which obviously involves 4 schools, the 4 schools being Washington University, Duke University, Johns Hopkins University, and the University of Pennsylvania. And the purpose of the program was to encourage people to take an interest in academic internal medicine. So this is sort of an unusual program in that students that have completed the 3rd year of medical school, in other words, having completed all of their clinical clerkships, like internal medicine, surgery, et cetera, before they go into the 4th year electives, will actually take a year out to do either basic science investigation or clinical research. And they have the opportunity to do research at any one of the 4 universities.
I see.
So each university typically picks 2 individuals, and the program then has 8 individuals per year, and they pick laboratories or clinical mentors to study with for that 1 year. Now, I mean, realistically, I tell the students, you know, it's impossible for us to really train you in a year's time. What it does is primarily to expose these individuals to really to address a couple of questions. One, what is the life of an academic physician? Mm-hmm. Two, might this be an area of research interest, whether it be clinical or basic science investigation, mm-hmm. that you may want to come back and pursue mm-hmm. after you finish your clinical training? So those are the primary goals of the program.
Okay. And do you have any of those students that you mentor?
No. I mean, I basically administer the program. We only have, like I said, two students per year mm-hmm. From each institution. And mm-hmm. It's been more difficult to recruit individuals into this program from Washington University because for this particular institution, there are already enormous number of research opportunities mm-hmm. for students between the first and second year, between the second and third year. Mm-hmm. So there's, you know, the pool of individuals who are actually interested in research after the third year becomes extremely small.
Yeah.
You know, a quarter of the class are MD-PhDs in our program. Yeah.
Really?
So somewhere between 25 and 30 students are MD-PhDs.
So the class is
about 125.
125. Wow.
We usually have anywhere from 2 to 6 students that get master's degrees mm-hmm. in conjunction with the MD degree. Mm-hmm. We usually have a handful of students that take a year out to go to the Howard Hughes Medical Institute fellowship or go to the NIH for a cloister program. Mm-hmm. So by the time the third year comes around, probably 50 students have already done research. Mm-hmm. So anybody that really is interested in clinical or basic science investigation have probably already taken off on one of those routes. Mm-hmm. So on average, we probably don't get 2 students per year. We may mm-hmm. average 1 student per year. Mm-hmm. And for those students, it's been a highly valuable experience.
Right.
But the pool is not that large.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, we're working our way through all the things you have to do as a PI. What about traveling? Some people travel a lot.
My wife tells me I travel a lot.
Okay. What's a lot?
That's a good question. I usually go to, my guess is probably maybe half a dozen meetings a year. And probably I'm visiting professor probably somewhere between 6 to 8 institutions per year. So I probably take about 12 to 14 trips a year. Seems more than that. Probably somewhere around there.
So a little more than once a month on average.
I think it averages out probably 1.5 times a month. Yeah, okay. That seems about right.
How does that impact? I mean, it seems to me of all the things one would do, that might be one of the more disruptive things because it literally takes you away.
Right. No, that's clearly very disruptive. The meetings are probably the most disruptive because there you're gone for multiple days. Mm-hmm. So, for example, the Keystone meetings are 4 to 5 days, and that's a long meeting. Mm-hmm. The FASA meetings are 4 to 5 days. Those are long meetings. Usually most people don't make it through the entire meeting. And then the other days where I am actually visiting professor, we're somewhat fortunate in St. Louis because we at least have a hub. We have TWA.
Right.
So I don't, you know, primarily for family reasons and other reasons, I don't usually get into town until midnight, the night before. And then I leave that following evening. So at most, I am at the institution probably for a whole 24 hours. And that makes it a little bit harder sometimes for me. Mm-hmm. But it also minimizes my time away. Mm-hmm. I remember one trip where I I had to go to San Diego to the Salk for a meeting. I took the 8 a.m. flight out of St. Louis. I was there by 10 a.m. I gave my talk at 3 o'clock, had dinner, and visited various people all afternoon. Then I took the midnight flight back. So I was back into St. Louis by 6 a.m. the following morning. So I'd actually only been gone for 22 hours. Mm-hmm. I don't know how long I can keep that up for. But still, that's pretty much how I try to minimize the time away. Mm-hmm. It's important to be able to go to the various places to interact with other investigators as well as a recruitment tool for your own laboratory in terms of graduate students.
Sure.
But it's also, as you point out, extremely disruptive. Mm-hmm. So I minimize the time away by having these crazy flight plans.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, one of the things that you have to do that non-MDs don't have to do is you probably have to do some attending.
Right.
What are your attending responsibilities?
So I have to attend on medicine, internal medicine, on the ward internal medicine service for 4 weeks. And I attend on the rheumatology consult service, the hospital consult service, for 4 weeks.
Are they the same 4 weeks, or are they two different?
I try to make it the same 4 weeks. And it actually works out pretty well, because usually for the internal medicine attending responsibilities, I usually start at 7:30, and by and large, I'm done by noon. And the first day I tell my rheumatology fellow, I tell him there are only 5 rheumatologic emergencies, and I don't want to be called, unless it's one of those 5, before 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. So then I begin my rheumatology round starting at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and go till whenever it takes us. Sometimes we're done by 6, sometimes we're done by 11 p.m., whatever it takes. But then that I still then am able to maintain 3 hours of sanity in my laboratory, in which case I have to deal with all the administrative stuff. I have my meetings organized so that I can meet with everybody in a timely fashion. And I can pretty much still run the lab pretty orderly during those 4 weeks.
They sound like they're 4 tough weeks, though.
They're 4 tough weeks, but, you know, I arrange it so that it's in the summertime, so there aren't as many seminars going on. Mm-hmm. There's no teaching going on. Mm-hmm. So basically, it's the same amount of time. Well, not the same amount of time. It's not that much of a trade-off as compared to the full-time academic months where there are seminars, there are teaching responsibilities, so it all evens out.
Okay.
And as long as you keep it pretty orderly, it by and large goes fine.
Mm-hmm. Now, is that something that you enjoy doing?
I actually enjoy doing it. I do it primarily for teaching purposes. You know, I bring a certain dimension of science into the medical arena that many other individuals that are not basic scientists cannot bring into their training. Mm-hmm. So, and hence, you know, I think it makes this particular university or academic centers such as this extremely unique. Mm-hmm. Because at a center like at Washington University at Barnes Hospital, the house staff are exposed to full-time clinicians. They're exposed to individuals like myself who are basic scientists, as well as private practitioners. So each one of us actually bring a totally different dimension of the science of medicine, the art of medicine, and medicine itself into their training. Mm-hmm. And they learn, you know, if it was just me or just a basic scientist, that's not a good experience. Mm-hmm. If it was solely the clinicians, that's probably not a complete experience. If it was just private practitioners, it would not be a complete experience. Mm-hmm. So I think it's important for me to be able to be on the wards for that purpose. Mm-hmm. And discussing many of the diseases actually, is still extremely interesting. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of a mystery. You're trying to figure out what the patient actually has. Mm-hmm. It's, in many ways, a scientific problem.
Right.
And you think about it in that way.
Well, I guess the flip side of that is you said that you like taking care of patients. Is a month a year enough?
No, it's a different way. I mean, I like taking care of patients. I had great experiences when I was a fellow. Mm-hmm. It's part of the reason why I went into rheumatology, because these are chronic illnesses. Mm-hmm. And it's not like you have an infectious disease, you have a pneumonia, you cure them, you never see the patients ever again. So it's a very unique subspecialty in that you develop certain bonds with the patients over long periods of time. Mm-hmm. You've seen them through three or four really, really bad flares of the lupus or rheumatoid mm-hmm. arthritis. And hence you build a special bond with them. So I miss that part now, because I think the only way to be able to do that is to do outpatient medicine. Mm-hmm. But with the emphasis that I have on my laboratory, I've had to give that up. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, when you have a sick patient, you have to take care of that problem. Mm-hmm. And I think it's extremely difficult to be basically on call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, in anticipation of that one sick patient, mm-hmm. and still be able to run a laboratory full time.
Sure.
That, I think, it becomes extremely difficult. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, what about, you know, people who practice medicine mm-hmm. daily mm-hmm. have a hard time keeping up with the newest and the latest and everything. They have to, you know, they have to work at keeping current. Mm-hmm. So, if you're only doing it 1 month out of the year, how do mm-hmm. you keep current?
Well, so let me just answer that in terms of rheumatology first. Okay, in terms of rheumatology, actually, I have the advantage being in an uh-huh. academic center. Mm-hmm. Because the drugs that are being developed, I've known about already for years. Mm-hmm. Okay, because they come out of basic science developments. Mm-hmm. So, for example, one of the more recent developments that came out 2 years ago for the treatment of rheumatoid arthritis is a drug that basically binds up cytokines. Okay, and we have known for that observation since 1990 that in the first model that was built, studying something totally unrelated, they were studying stability of messenger RNAs. Mm-hmm. And what they found out was that there's a particular cytokine called TNF, tumor necrosis factor, which had this very unusual regulation. Mm-hmm. And they were studying the regulation of this gene when they deleted a part of the gene, and lo and behold, they got this regulation of TNF, and the mouse got arthritis. So that observation we've known about, and obviously the obvious thing to say is, well, what's going to happen with soluble TNF receptor mm-hmm. or an antibody that's directed against TNF? Mm-hmm. And we've kept up with those kinds of literature, mm-hmm. you know, 7 years before the drug came out. Right. So from that standpoint, we already are well aware, based on other basic science findings, what the next entire generation of drugs that are going to come out are. So knowing that kind of information, you know, the problem is that clinical studies take a long time.
Sure.
So I don't necessarily have to read every piece of information between now and then, uh-huh. because I'm just waiting for the major trial to be completed, and I'll know what the result is. Right. So from that standpoint, doing rheumatology isn't so difficult. It's actually easier. Mm-hmm. From the standpoint of general internal medicine, I think that's much harder. Mm-hmm. But again, that's the advantage of being an academic center. Grand rounds, for example, here, you cover all the major topics. Mm-hmm. So within an hour, you should, without having to go to the primary literature, you will have the most up-to-date seminar mm-hmm. on that particular field, with a discussion with the shortcomings and the strengths of every study.
Mm-hmm. So you go to grand rounds regularly?
We go to grand rounds, not regularly, but you know, there are enough mm-hmm. colleagues around that right. you know this kind of right. Stuff is going on. There are general internal medicine mm-hmm. journal clubs. Mm-hmm. And then when you're in it, actually you learn a lot when you're actually attending on medicine. Mm-hmm. So when you're on general internal medicine, if there is an issue, you can always ask for a consultation. So then the subspecialist will come in, whether mm-hmm. it be the cardiologist and nephrologist, mm-hmm. and say, well, these are the studies, mm-hmm. these are the data. Mm-hmm. So you learn also sort of on the job,
right,
as to what the latest stuff is.
Right.
So with that collection, actually, it's not that hard. Mm-hmm. I mean, the house staff here are really clinically very, very outstanding.
Mm-hmm.
I think where our decisions come in to play really is a judgment issue,
mm-hmm.
okay, is being able to recognize the forest from the trees.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and sometimes I remember as a house staff, you're inundated with so much information. This consultant says this, but this is an apparent contradiction to this.
Right.
And as attending, when you don't have to deal with those issues on a minute-to-minute basis, you go, wait a minute, this is so simple, this is ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
Don't worry about this.
Mm-hmm.
We have to be able to decide upon this issue. This is clearly the most important issue.
Mm-hmm.
And then these become secondary issues.
Mm-hmm.
This is the definitive issue that needs to be addressed. So it's
mm-hmm.
sort of just more guiding the house staff in being able to recognize and prioritize what the major issues
mm-hmm.
are.
Mm-hmm.
And in many ways, the science is very helpful to that, because
mm-hmm.
you always have a zillion possible experiments to do. And yet, by prioritizing and recognizing what experiments are going to make or break your hypothesis, you develop a certain degree of clarity in terms of thinking.
Right.
And if you can apply that to clinical medicine, the same thing holds. I mean, I remember many clinical situations where you're always sort of in a bind with a patient that has bad coronary artery disease,
mm-hmm.
that also has kidney disease.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is that you need to subject that particular patient to a cardiac catheterization, but then by giving the patient dye, they're going to end up with end-stage dialysis, or they're going to have to dialyze them.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, the attending comes in and goes, well, this is all superfluous. What you need to ask is the surgeon going to operate at all? Because
mm-hmm.
if the surgeon's not going to operate, I don't need to know what the anatomy is.
Mm-hmm.
There's no reason whatsoever to subject mm-hmm. that patient to the dye load anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, or if the surgeons are waffling and say, this is the situation, would you, even with the worst disease, operate? And if the answer is no, then there's no reason to know.
Right.
And that's just comes sort of experience
mm-hmm.
and being able to recognize sort of the bigger picture
right.
as to what to do. So from that standpoint, I actually feel very comfortable attending on medicine. But then again, you know, if I was out in the front lines
mm-hmm.
And not non-academic center, I think the story would be very, very different.
Yeah. Okay. How are we doing time-wise for
you? Actually, we're fine. You want to break now or you want to break in 10, 15 minutes?
It's up to you. Well, let's keep going.
Okay.
All right. Well, the last thing that I can think of that takes up time,
mm-hmm.
or takes up some people's time, let's see if it takes up your time, but there are a couple things that some people spend time on and others don't. One is the internet,
mm-hmm.
which can consume a great deal of time,
mm-hmm.
and the other actually is television.
Mm-hmm.
Do you spend any time on either one of those?
So, internet-wise, I mean, the only thing I usually access the internet through is, you know, primarily for data searches, the library.
Mm-hmm.
I don't use the library anymore.
Mm.
Everything is electronic.
Library's in your office now.
The library's in my office. I don't have, basically, mm-hmm. I can access almost any article.
Mm-hmm.
And now, actually, what I do is that every article I download is in my computer.
Uh-huh.
So I don't even actually keep a hard copy of the paper.
Uh-huh.
So if I need to print it up, I'll basically pull it directly from my
mm-hmm.
computer.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, I don't use the computer that much. I mean, in terms of the internet,
mm-hmm.
which is probably antiquated
mm-hmm.
For present day stuff. We're just sort of I don't use it that much otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
Television. I actually find it, depending how hard I work that day, to be sort of totally mindless for me.
Yeah.
It's basically noise, but I turn mm-hmm. it on and then I read the newspaper.
I see.
But it's background noise. Maybe mm-hmm. it's part of growing up that, you know, I had mm-hmm. three other kid brothers and sisters mm-hmm. and, you know, in a very loud family that you just need some sort of noise. I just don't like it when I sit
mm-hmm.
when I'm trying to relax in a dead silent room. It doesn't work out well. Mm-hmm. I always feel like there's something wrong. Mm-hmm. So I turn it on, and basically it's I go into a vegetative state while I'm doing something else or that. That's about it.
Okay. So when you consider all the things that you do, which is, you know, the grant writing, the paper mm-hmm. writing, the administrative, the committees, all the things mm-hmm. that we talked about, is there any time left to be at the bench?
There is, actually. That's why I'm going in and out right now. I'm doing the experiment.
Oh, okay.
It depends, okay? Uh-huh. When I'm going out of town, it's very hard for me to do anything, mm-hmm. okay? But there are still certain things that I can do, you know, because usually the people in the lab are pretty already maxed out in terms of the things that they can do. And sometimes I come up with a particular idea of a particular experiment I want to do that may require me to make a certain construct, certain mm-hmm. cDNAs. Mm-hmm. And that is pretty mindless. I mean, that's basically you can start, you can stop, you can start, you can stop, you can throw it in the freezer. Mm-hmm. So that I still do. Mm-hmm. I make certain constructs and then I, you know, mm-hmm. hand it off to somebody else mm-hmm. just because of manpower issues. Mm-hmm. But I also find it, you know, many times it is extremely time demanding for that issue because I feel like I'm always running around trying to do two different things or three different things at the same time. Mm-hmm. It's important to be able to do the lab work because otherwise you could never troubleshoot for people. And a lot of it is just basically troubleshooting. Mm-hmm.
Do you like it?
No, I like the lab work.
You like the lab work.
You know, a lot of the scientific work takes a long time before you know you get an answer. Whereas, you know, you do molecular biology, at least you have the satisfaction to know that you got it right. Mm-hmm. You completed that particular ligation, or you sequenced mm-hmm. the cDNA and it was correct. Mm-hmm. So from those standpoints, those are sort of the very small benefits mm-hmm. of life, the little mm-hmm. short-term gratifications.
Mm-hmm. So, from talking to you, it sounds like you're somebody who's really good at organization and sort of making things fit together. But how do you juggle all this stuff? I mean, seems like there's a million.
I mean, I think everybody organizes to some degree. Mm-hmm. It just depends how haphazard one wants to be. Mm-hmm. Other people like extremely well organized lives, and I can tell you mine is not like that. You know, and I'm sometimes a procrastinator in certain things, and things sit on my desk for a long periods of time. Mm-hmm. I tried a while, you know, to have this policy whereby I only touch every piece of paper once.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's this, you know, I knew somebody, basically, I asked him, you know, how do you get organized? And he goes, well, I touch every piece of paper only once, so that I touch it, I make a decision, it's done. I don't put it on my desk and let it sit, and I, you know, they have to keep coming back to it. Mm-hmm. And that can be done for certain things. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I try to do that when it's very, very straightforward and simple. Mm-hmm. And then, but there's obviously lots of things in science that just can't be done in it. And mm-hmm. that goes to a different pile. Mm-hmm. So, the organization, I think, nonetheless, is extremely important so mm-hmm. that you have some idea what it is that you're going to accomplish that day, mm-hmm. What it is you're going to accomplish 3 days from now, and what is it that you have to do today to get ready for 3 days from now. Mm-hmm. But it is always a juggling act. You always feel like you have five different things going on. Mm-hmm. I think that's life. You know, my philosophy is that, well, if I have nothing left to do, then probably I'm dead. But there's always something to do.
Oh, yeah.
There's always something to do.
Yeah. Okay.
I think in science that's always true. There's always something else that you can think about. Mm-hmm. There's always something else you can look at. Mm-hmm. I know of no, you know, scientists who are basically, you know, who feel that they have nothing to do or they have a huge right. amount of spare time.
Right. Well, you know, yesterday you had, or Tuesday you had talked a little bit about how having children has sort of changed the way, or the number of hours that you spend here, mostly on the weekends, I think.
Right. I mean, as well as during the week. I mean, you know, if I was single, I could easily see putting in probably 3 or 4 more hours per day.
Oh, really?
I mean, as graduate students, that's what we did. Yeah. You know, we would be here in the morning, you're here in the afternoon, you go home, you eat dinner, or you eat dinner around here, you go back to the lab and work till 10 or 11 o'clock. Then you go home. You come back the next day at 8 o'clock in the morning. That's what a graduate student, most graduate students did when I was a graduate student. And still, that's what a lot of graduate students do now. I mean, they are working 12, 15 hours a day, 6 to 7 days a week sometimes.
Has doing that, cutting back your time, had any real impact on your productivity, or did you just get more efficient?
No, I think it's twofold, okay? I think when you are a postdoctoral fellow, you are in, okay? It's your hands. When you go home, your career stops at that point.
Stops, yeah.
Whereas as a PI, it's different because you have built a laboratory of 10 to 12 people. And yeah, they're not working at night. A lot of them are not working at night, but it's not just your work. I mean, you're not the only sole set of hands there. You have 10 to 12 additional sets of hands. And yeah, there are 10 other projects I'd like to be able to embark upon today, but the number of hands don't allow us to do that. So I think that's just one of those realities that we have to accept. You basically have to prioritize what are the best experiments. What are the experiments that have potentially had the greatest payoff? And go from there.
What is a typical day in your life?
Let's take a break.
We'll do that when we come back.
All right, give me a...
Okay, we're back on tape after a science break. So I think I had just asked you to kind of take me through a typical day. A typical day in the life of Andy Chan.
So typically, I get in probably sometime between 8 and 9 o'clock, depending what's going on in the morning.
Do you do anything at home first? I mean, do you
to school? No. Our nanny comes in at 7:30.
Okay.
My wife usually has morning meetings, so usually she comes in early.
Okay.
And I come in later after she arrives.
Okay.
So I only have to take care of myself in the morning, usually. There are rare instances when she's out of town or something like that I have to get the kids up and get them breakfast, et cetera. But usually I just have to take care of myself, so I get in sometime between 8 and 9.
Okay.
And usually I have some time to take care of just administrative issues. You know, emails, phone calls, that sort of thing by about 9 o'clock. And most days, especially during the earlier part of the week, I then pretty much have meetings from 9 till about 4 to 5 with various people in the laboratory. Because, you know, as I said before, I meet with my graduate students every week. I have an hour and a half slotted for each one of those people. Each one of my technicians has an hour and a half slotted for it. And I meet with my postdocs once every 2 to 3 weeks for an hour and a half. And then there are various seminars and meetings during the day. So by about Thursday, usually my schedule is a little bit less hectic because I tend to centralize my meetings with the people in the lab during the first 3 days of the week. And depending again whether I'm out of town or whether I'm doing lab work, that they may be interspersed by various experiments. And then somehow, usually when I look up, you know, it's 5:30, I should be getting ready to go home, and next thing I know, it's 7:30 and 8 o'clock. So I usually get home probably sometime between 7 and 8, usually on the weekdays. So that's my hour-wise, my typical day.
Now, do you...
Do you eat with your kids, or they've already?
No, they eat very early. They get grouchy if they don't eat by about 5 o'clock in the afternoon.
Okay. So when you get home, I know you said you play with them for a while.
Yeah.
Okay. And then they go to bed.
Depending on their mood.
Their mood. Okay.
No, it's not up to me.
Uh-huh. Okay.
It just depends what activities they're doing that particular evening.
Okay. Okay. And then after, if they're not interested in you, or after they go to bed, what do you do?
I mean, sometimes, more recently it's been more hard. It's on the weekdays by about 9 o'clock and 10 o'clock. I'm not in a capacity that I can concentrate on.
Okay.
So there, you know, I just take care of bills, mm-hmm. read the newspaper, mm-hmm. deal with house issues, mm-hmm.
Okay.
things like that.
Okay.
It's pretty boring. Nothing exciting.
How about the weekends then? Because I know you said you don't spend more than a few hours.
So usually in the weekends, you know, again, it sort of depends what my wife's schedule is, because half the time she has to come in to round in the mornings. Mm-hmm. She has to come in to round in the mornings. I usually can't come in the mornings, although there are some times where I have appointments scheduled for Saturday morning, in which case we can usually get our nanny to come in on Saturday mornings. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, usually for whatever reason, my kids like Dunkin' Donuts, so we end up going to Dunkin' Donuts on Saturday morning. We usually run errands throughout the morning.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pretty boring weekend. Sometimes I intersperse it if I want some things to do. My kids actually are at the age where actually I can bring them into the lab,
mm-hmm.
and they can stay in my office, you know, doodle on the board and things like that for at least a couple hours.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I can get a little bit of work done mm-hmm. between that kind of scheduling.
What do you do for fun?
The only thing I really do for fun is, outside of work, is play tennis.
Uh-huh.
You know, I used to play a lot of different sports, but it's hard to come up with 9 other people that want to play basketball.
Right.
Or a lot of people that play football.
Uh-huh.
So one of the few sports that I can still play, you know, you only have to get one or three other additional individuals to play tennis.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, I play a lot of tennis.
Mm-hmm.
I try to play, I usually at least play twice a week.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes I can get three times a week.
Mm-hmm.
But that's about it.
Does Mary play, or...?
Mary does play.
Uh-huh.
She just started taking up tennis about a year ago.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
So I haven't played consistently with her yet.
Uh-huh.
That's the plan.
That's the plan.
That's the plan.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Now, you know, this is just a little aside, but mm-hmm. an interesting one, I think. But, you know, you were raised with this sort of understanding that, you know, you were expected to achieve educationally.
Mm-hmm.
How do you handle your own kids in that respect?
Mm-hmm. And that's hard.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, both of us, both Mary and I, feel pretty comfortable with our kids' educations.
Mm-hmm.
We don't do anything, I think, out of the ordinary to push them, as far as I can tell. I mean, they go to public schools.
Mm-hmm.
They happen to be in a very, very good school district.
Mm-hmm.
Each of the kids excel in their different ways. And we just try to increase their exposure to a variety of different things that are available around town. You know, there are some opportunities, for example, at the art museum that, you know, had my daughter go to this summer. They're going to go to a variety of activities at the botanical gardens. But it's really more of trying to increase their breadth
mm-hmm.
than it is necessarily pushing them
mm-hmm.
in terms of depth right now. Because I think that will come.
Mm-hmm.
That's just a matter of time. They're only in first grade.
Mm-hmm.
The things that Mary and I have tried to emphasize is just to increase the diversity of exposures.
Mm-hmm.
But that's about it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I mean, even the classes themselves, they don't have anything that really pushes the students until third grade.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, I don't have any preconceived notions, at least right now, as to what they will do.
Mm-hmm.
I think fields are very, very different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether one wants to be a social scientist, a scientist, humanities, etc. I mean, I think both of us expect them to go to college, but not necessarily anything subspecialized at this particular
mm-hmm.
point.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I want to shift gears a little bit now mm-hmm. and talk about your work.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe you can tell me a little bit about, you know, what you're
the
doing.
The work that we're doing now.
That you're doing now. Okay. And keeping in mind that the people that look at this in the future will probably more likely be historians.
Sure.
Historians of science, so mm-hmm. they're mm-hmm. not going to be completely clueless.
Right.
But
so the major interests or the major questions that we like to address really are centered on what are the biochemical mechanisms that permit immune cells to function. And in our laboratory, we began with studies in the T lymphocyte, or the T cell, primarily because that's what I was predominantly trained in.
Mm-hmm.
And over the last few years, we have now expanded our interest to other cells in the immune system, most notably the B lymphocyte. So again, during my postdoctoral training, what you know I had been trained in was trying to, I had identified one new level of regulation
mm-hmm.
in the signaling mechanisms of the T cell antigen receptor. And we've continued our studying this particular enzyme that we coined called ZAP70. And we've been interested in how this particular enzyme is regulated during signaling events,
mm-hmm.
how this enzyme regulates the development of cells, and more recently, you know, how, by utilizing this particular molecule as a switch